1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Happy days are here again, Ironside Chatters. Welcome to the Ride of Rides. Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke, and trying to stay sane in an insane world. From sunny San Diego, I'm Greg Carlwood, and today I got a guest whose work I've been reading online for quite some time. His name's Jim Fetzer. I think he does a lot of great evidence-based research, and today we're slaying a lot of the propaganda dragons of the past and discussing the Jade Helm operation, which really does have me a little bit concerned. September-October 2015 is shaping up to be a time to watch. I'd say make sure you have some cash on hand, which won't be an issue for this month's Money Bomb winner, taking home $310 from the listeners that be. We're going to hear from her real quick, and then we're getting serious with the man who knows the plan, as Jim Fetzer gives his perspective on several of history's sacred cows. Enjoy.
Have a drink and a smoke. Listen to the cast. We shine a shiny spotlight, put criminals on blast. The pinstripe men of mourning and families of finance. DuPont, Windsor, and Rothschild, the kids don't stand a chance.
Hi friends, my name is Donna, I'm 33 years old, and I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I just won $310 on the THC Money Bomb. Thank you so much. I'm so excited. This money will make it possible for me to visit my sister who lives in Southern California. It's been 7 years since I've been able to visit her, and it will mean so much to both of us for me to head west this winter and surprise her. And I'll definitely be putting a nice chunk of it back into the pool for someone else to enjoy and extending my Hireside Chat subscription. I've really been enjoying the show a lot. Some of my favorites have been Wayne Bush discussing language and symbolism, Kate of Gaia blowing minds with the legal name game, as well as Jason Miller, Sorcerer Supreme. I would love to hear Greg interview Grant Morrison on the personal use of sigils, as well as the super sigils used by corporations to shape our perception of reality and subconsciously control our roles in society. I'm also very interested in history, weird history, and I'd love to hear a discussion about what Jack Parsons was really up to in Pasadena in the 1940s and the occult strangeness that led to the founding of the Jet Propulsion Lab and the U.S. Rocket Program. So once again, thank you so much, everyone. And thank you, Greg, for having the courage to quit your 9-to-5 to make this program happen and reach out to so many people. I'm thrilled to be a part of it. Take care, everyone. Thanks again, and have a great day.
I said the kids don't stand.
All right, guys, we are no stranger to the idea that many of the biggest events in world history and modern times are not just random occurrences, and in many cases, the stories as we know them to be have been heavily manipulated to make the masses think in a desired way. Well, today we're going to examine several of these stories and how they're probably closer to carefully crafted illusions from the shadowy puppet masters of the power pyramid and their same old playbook than they are events as we're told. With me to do that is Jim Fetzer, a guy who's been throwing stones at the glass house of the New World Order for quite some time. Jim is a former Marine Corps officer, a researcher who has lectured at universities, and has authored many great pieces on the foundations of scientific knowledge, cognitive science, and many more. Since the mid-1990s, he has been focused on tearing down the veil of manipulation installed by the nefarious elite and restoring truth to the world, where he's been on quite a roll. Most recently, he's been working on a series of books comprised of articles and exposés by some of today's leading voices in the conspiratorial community. The one of which we're focused on today is called And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either, The Beatles, The Holocaust, and Other Mass Illusions. Well, that probably wins the provocative title award from me. Jim, my man, welcome to THC.
Oh, great. It's terrific. What a wonderful introduction.
Thanks, man. Thanks. This really is a treat. We've got a lot to talk about, a ton of diversity in these topics. Always my favorite way to do a show. So I guess to kick things off, tell us a little bit about how this book came to be and some of the authors involved. You got some great names in here, man.
Yeah, there are. Just terrific. We got 13 contributors to this book, including Jay Wiedner, Nicholas Kullerstrom, PhD, Yvonne Wachter, Robert Forreson, PhD, Thomas Dalton, PhD, anonymous scholar, Mike Palachek, Jim Mars, Winston Wu, James A. Larson, James H. Fetzer, PhD, yours truly, Zen Gardner, Sterling Harwood. He has both a JD and a PhD. The series originated with the fertile mind of Mike Palachek, Greg, who had the idea of a Save the World, Resist the Empire series with four projected volumes. This turns out to be number two, although originally intended to be number three, after one to be entitled Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, which would raise the provocative question, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either.
Ah, yeah, that makes sense. The titles kind of flow together in that way. But the first one, the Sandy Hook one's not quite out yet, is it?
That's right. We had production difficulties, but that actually turns to be a boon, because given the Boston trial, I published many more articles about it. We have more powerful evidence about the fraudulent character of what happened in Boston. The trial, it was a complete sham. I have interviewed the aunt of the two brothers who were falsely accused. We now have the absurdity of him confessing to a crime he didn't commit. I mean, the amount of evidence that this was a drill is simply overwhelming. If anyone wants to check it out, let me recommend two sources. One is the Real Deal Special Must-See Boston Bombing Update on YouTube, and the other is an article on my blog at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com entitled They Didn't Do It, Marette Serenova Blows Apart the Boston Show Trial.
Man. Yeah, that was definitely an interesting saga. And one strange thing to me is, I guess, when you're making these two brothers patsies, that you got the, of course, the Middle Eastern sentiment, and you're also hitting Russian, too, which seems to be an element in trying to stir up some type of added controversy there.
That's right. They appear to have been picked because they were Muslims, because they were associated with Chechnya, so it could be used for double or triple effect to tarnish Muslims, make them out to be terrorists. And also, you know, try to smear Vladimir Putin, at least indirectly. But in fact, they had nothing to do with it. Their aunt, Marette, who is actually a lawyer herself, pointed out to me that even the footage of the young men at the Boston Marathon had been faked, because they show Tamerlan, the older brother, to be clean-shaven, when at the time he had a beard. I asked her to prove it, and she sent me a photograph of him lying in bed with his cat. He had a beard. She sent me a link to them working out in a gymnasium shortly before the bombing. He had a beard. She directed me to a friend who had contacted Tamerlan that day, relieved to learn he'd been nowhere in the vicinity of the bombing. They had dinner together that night. He had a beard. There's surveillance footage showing Zocher inside and Tamerlan outside. He has a beard. Even when he's arrested, his arrest footage, if it's not been fuzzied up, he's got a beard. And of course, then we get the death photograph, and he's still got the beard, Greg. Plus, in addition, you know, the fact that he was arrested before he was found dead reflects how gullible is the American public, because his brother allegedly ran over him with his SUV. But how could he have done that after he was arrested and in police custody? The fact is, we have a witness who said she watched the police drive over him three times with a vehicle which appears to have been Tamerlan's own car. I mean, this is outrageous. So once he's arrested, there's no way that the brother could have run over him, and yet that's one of the claims that was made in convicting him of this crime. Third, I consulted a professor of law about the most basic evidence, and he zoomed in on the backpacks. It states right in the FBI's investigative report that the two backpacks that blew up were both black nylon backpacks. It even states that in the indictment for him for the Boston show trial. But even in the footage that the government's produced, neither of the backpacks that Zocher or Tamerlan are wearing is a black nylon backpack. As a professor concluded, that means there wasn't even probable cause for an arrest or an indictment, much less conviction at a trial.
Huh, man, great summary there. Yeah, a lot of holes in that story. Yeah, and that's just one of many things, many, many flawed narratives that we get from the nefarious elite. But man, to get talk about this book, I absolutely loved it. Maybe we can unpack some of these stories in there and make the case that they are, in fact, mass illusions. Some of them are a little more emotionally charged than others, but let's start with the moon landings. It's related to a lot of things we've been talking about on the show lately, but we haven't really dove into the evidence in all that much detail. So what are some of your go-to points that show that the moon landings were a sham?
Well, the NASA itself acknowledged on 30 August 2012 that the principal obstacle to a manned mission to Mars was overcoming the Van Allen radiation, Greg, but the Van Allen radiation belt has been there since the creation of Earth about 4.5 billion years ago. So if it's a problem now, it was obviously a problem in the late 1960s. The astronauts' suits appear to have been costumes. They would have been incapable of protecting them from radiation exposure. We have a stunning assortment of photographs that are anomalous. Frankly, I believe that because of the effects of cosmic rays, it would have been impossible to take any photographs on the moon anyway, because they would have interrupted with the photographic plates. Mm. But the cameras that were purportedly used are mounted external to the astronaut suits, and they can't even be focused or framed. And yet we have thousands of photographs, each of which is perfectly focused and framed. I mean, that's just incredible and completely inconsistent with the method that was purportedly used to take them. We have lots of anomalous photographs. For example, you got a moon lander where there's no blasted out crater beneath, which the jets of the lander would have dislodged as it was coming down to settle. There's not even any dust on the pods of the lander. I mean, that's obvious indication of fakery. We have moon rovers where there's no tracks up to the location of the rover, no tracks in front, behind, or in the middle. Clearly, they were lowered into place using a crane. We have a purely quantitative argument coming from an expert by the name of Jack White, who was a legendary contributor to JFK Research. Jack and I spent many years collaborating together. He took a great interest in the moon landing and has a whole archive online, Jack White's Apollo Moon Studies, which I recommend anyone to track down. I use several of them in the book. But what he did was just to count up the number of visits. We have six different trips to the moon, the amount of time spent there, and the number of photographs taken. And listen to this, Greg. The agency wants the world to believe that 5,771 photographs were taken in 4,834 minutes. If nothing but photography had been done, such a feat is clearly impossible, made even more so by all the documented activities of the astronauts. Imagine 1.19 photos every minute that men were on the moon. That's one picture every 50 seconds. I mean, that's a purely quantitative argument, Greg, but it's devastating.
Yeah. It's something that you wouldn't have thought of if you were on a soundstage, just taking staged pictures of how, you wouldn't have thought about the duration of time. But yeah, that's compelling evidence.
Well, another important consideration is, of course, the moon rocks, which many regard as the most powerful evidence that man went to the moon. But what they don't realize is that Wernher von Braun, who was the leading rocket expert brought over with other Nazi scientists and intelligence officers and incorporated into our own intelligence apparatus, had not only proposed a rocket to go to the moon, it was three times the size of the Empire State Building, and he'd suggested we'd need several of them in order to make it feasible. But he undertook a visit to Antarctica in the local summer of 1966-67, which appears to have included gathering lunar rocks that had been dislodged from the moon's surface by the impact of asteroids and captured by the Earth's gravitational field, which meant that bona fide moon rocks could be produced, but which had not reached Earth via Apollo missions.
Wow. So that's interesting. I also had heard that astronauts had been caught giving petrified wood to other countries, saying that they were moon rocks, giving them that as gifts. Is that true?
Well, that was rather embarrassing. Yet a piece of alleged moon rock was given to the Netherlands and wound up in a museum, but turned out to be a piece of petrified wood. I think, they just got a bit slovenly about all of this. We have some, studies that have been extremely revealing. I first got hooked on the moon during a visit to London in 2001 when I was I had given a keynote address to the British Society for the Philosophy of Science the year before, and I knew my wife would enjoy it so much that I brought her to London, and we stayed in the Morgan Hotel, which backs onto the British Museum. I chose it because her maiden name was Morgan. It's on Bloomsbury Street. And when we were there, we turned on the BBC on one of the channels. It was showing conspiracy theory. Did we land on the moon? And I was captivated because it showed so many arguments that we had not gone to the moon, which were scientifically based. My own PhD is in the history and the philosophy of science. So arguments that are based upon the laws of physics, chemistry, biology, and so forth have tremendous appeal to me. And this was explaining the technical and scientific reasons why our having gone to the moon was impossible, and illustrating it with a whole host of examples, including for that when the moon lander takes off from the surface of the moon, it appears to be being yanked upward by a cable. There's just a host. When you slow down, for example, doing the moonwalk or speed it up, the astronauts walking on the surface of the moon, it's obvious that this was actually footage that was taken on Earth, where the gravitational attraction is six times greater, that had been slowed down to create the impression that they were only able to move very slowly. But their height would have been greater than had happened had it actually been on the moon. And it's all one more form of fakery to which we have been subjected.
Man. So this Van Allen radiation belt issue, have humans ever crossed it? Will we ever be able to cross it?
Well, it's unlikely. And, you know, when you stop and think about it, the way a scientific project would be conducted, you would first send animals, maybe rats or monkeys or whatnot, to see whether or not they could survive the Van Allen radiation belt. None of that was done, and yet we purportedly took trip after trip after trip to the moon completely successfully with no injuries, no serious problems. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Gus Grissom was one of the astronauts who was very concerned about the quality of the project, where they couldn't even manipulate the moon lander in Earth's stronger gravitational field, which would have made it that much simpler. He even hung a lemon over his desk, indicating what he thought about the whole moon landing hoax. He and two others were dry roasted in an Apollo capsule, which had been filled with pure oxygen. It was clear it was set off deliberately to extinguish him and any other thoughts any other astronauts might have about blowing the whistle on the program.
Wow. Another interesting thing about that is that NASA says the original footage was lost. You'd think they'd keep a keen eye on some of the first off-world footage that they've gotten.
Greg, this is absurd. I mean, you're talking about what if it were authentic would be the most precious footage ever taken by the hand of man. For NASA to have lost it, there were some seven boxes, is preposterous. There's no way that could happen. That would be like the National Archives claiming they'd lost the copy they have of the Zapruder film. Now, that copy of the Zapruder film in the National Archives is not the original out of camera, which we have demonstrated dozens of different ways. But the NASA footage was all fabricated and fake with modern digital technology. That would have been easy to show. So they simply misplaced it. It's lost, seemingly forever.
Right. Yeah, it's very convenient. They look at the modern tools and they say, well, shit, we can't show people this. They're going to figure it out. So they just say they lost it. And that's not even a good cover story.
That's right. I'm told, actually, they're going through and systematically removing a lot of moon photographs. For example, some show shadows cast in more than one direction, which would have been impossible if these were authentic, because the sun would be the only source of light, and it's at such great distance. The only shadows cast would be indistinguishable parallel lines, but they use some sources of light that were much too close to the set, and therefore you have some objects, you know, being casting shadows in one direction, more nearby objects casting shadows in a different direction, which would be impossible had this been authentic.
Yeah. And now I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but how much of NASA and what they've done has been a fraud? Can we trust them on anything if they're lying to us about something so huge?
I think it's doubtful that you can trust NASA on anything. My understanding is that a clear table of organization would show NASA is actually a branch of the CIA, and you know how reliable they are in bringing us accurate information about events abroad and at home. I mean, we're in a terrible strait, I'm afraid, Greg, where all we can depend upon, given the extent to which the major media is dominated now by propaganda made recently legal by the NDAA 2013, whereas it had been heretofore illegal for the government agencies to disseminate propaganda on the American people. That's now been legalized. And I'm sorry to say we're being subjected to a massive, and I don't think we can believe anything NASA ever says again.
And isn't there a pretty disturbing quote from a former CIA director, something to the effect of, we'll know our job is complete when everything the American people believe to be true is actually a lie?
I like that so much, Greg, that I actually put it on the back of the book. William Casey, director of the CIA, he was Ronald Reagan's director, was reported to have told his staff, our disinformation campaign will be a success when everything the American people believe is false. And they seem to have done a pretty good job of it, where this book explains how we know that we did not go to the moon but faked it, that Paul McCartney died and was replaced, that we hung a double, not Saddam, that Osama died in Afghanistan, not Pakistan, that the Holocaust was different than historians claim. Whereas you observe, Greg, some of these are very emotional issues, the moon landing and the Holocaust no doubt being the prime examples.
Yeah, man, and I do want to get into the Holocaust. My last question about the moon landing is, do you think there's any truth to the story that Stanley Kubrick was involved in helping them fake that footage?
Well, Jay Wedner has a brilliant contribution here. He's done a great deal to expose the role of Stanley Kubrick. He appears to have been given funding for his magisterial 2001 A Space Odyssey to fake the landing, which was done using a technique known as front screen projection. The chapter by Jay illustrates and explains exactly how it was done. One of the signs of front screen projection is that the background is just as well defined and in focus as the foreground, which is impossible with normal optical equipment. If these had been real, that would be impossible. But by faking it, you get precisely that result, which revealed how it was done, as Jay explains. There's also a brilliant chapter there by a fellow named Winston Wu, who has done a conspiracy trilogy talking about JFK, 9/11, and the moon landing. Winston's work on the moon landing was so brilliant that I incorporated it as the longest chapter in the book, where he offers 35 reasons we didn't go to the moon. They're devastating, Greg, simply devastating.
Yeah, that was probably my favorite moon landing portion, because it's just bullet point after bullet point, 35 reasons. And even if you can dismiss half of them, you can't explain it all, and you'd have to show that it was true footage.
That's right. That's exactly right. And, you know, even the astronauts' conduct and behavior when they had their interview, they didn't act excited, thrilled to have been on the moon. They act sheepish. They acted like they were unhappy with themselves, and it's because they were playing a role. They were actors in a script. One of the best films that reveals how this was done is a classic starring James Brolin, O.J. Simpson, and Elliot Gould, entitled Capricorn One, about faking a trip to Mars, which we now know from NASA cannot be done because they can't overcome the Van Allen radiation belt. But it explains how, using a single feed of grainy television footage from a set, they were able to fake and create the impression to the public they'd actually gone. It's a wonderful film if you want to understand better how easily this could be brought about.
That is interesting. So on the you mentioned the astronauts, and something else that's kind of interesting to me, and it's kind of a big theme in the conspiracy world, is some people go the other direction and bring up cases of the astronauts talking about seeing UFOs or aliens on their way to the moon. Now, if they didn't go, of course, that didn't happen. But it's kind of curious that they would add that layer to the story or feed that through.
Well, I got to admit, that's an aspect I have not really examined, and it is intriguing, but very, very curious, very, very curious. I mean, you know, we do have reports of advanced technology. Whether it had alien origin is a whole nother matter. We have to distinguish between UFOs as unidentified flying objects and those that are specifically of alien origin. I don't have any doubt about the existence of many UFOs. We have too many encounters to deny it. But they would, by and large, be explicable on the basis of advanced technology that we had developed, some of it using Nazi scientific research.
Right, right. Man, it's such an interesting saga. And Now let's look at the Holocaust. This one obviously is a little more emotional for some people. We know that there was a lot of manipulation around World War II, but questioning the Holocaust can be pretty challenging for some people. How did you find yourself going down this rabbit hole?
Well, I had by and large taken for granted that the official narrative of the Holocaust, including that 6 million Jews had been put to death in special gas chambers using Zyklon B, was on the up and up and authentic, until I was invited to participate in a conference a couple of years ago on academic freedom. Are there limits to inquiry, using JFK, 9/11, and the Holocaust as examples? And as I began my research on the Holocaust, I discovered almost right off the bat that the figure 6 million does not have historical or empirical basis, but appears to be rooted in theology in a disputed passage in Leviticus that suggests that the chosen people can return to the promised land only when they're minus 6 million who have been consumed in the flames. Now, that requires an interpolation, because there's no actual figure for 6 million in the original language. But it turns out, Greg, astonishingly enough, that there are no less than 236 references to 6 million Jews in dire straits or in fear of loss of their lives in the international news prior to the Nuremberg Tribunal the first, as early as 1890. So, you know, this 6 million clearly isn't a matter of history. It's not a matter of facts. It's a matter of an article of faith. And where the best empirical data we have about the numbers comes from the International Committee of the Red Cross, which was going to the camps and keeping very meticulous records, and which updated their research in 1993, where the total for all the camps, now these are gypsies, Jews, the mentally and physically infirm, the total for all the camps was 296,081 combined, decidedly less than 6 million. And in fact, it's startling, but there turned out to be more Catholics than Jews died at Auschwitz, for example, Greg. But it's very difficult for the public to wrap its mind around the difference between the story they've been told and the facts of the matter when you conduct serious research.
Wow, the fact that more Catholics died at Auschwitz than Jews. I'd heard you say that in previous interviews, and I've read a little bit about that. That is pretty shocking and kind of new to me. For people who might be skeptical of that, where does that data come from? From the Red Cross data?
Yeah. From the International Committee on the Red Cross, it's available multiple places. Let me recommend an especially good source is a new book entitled Breaking the Spell by Nicholas Kollerstrom. You heard me mention his name. Nick is an historian of science. He's the leading expert on the London subway bombings, the 7/7 bombings. His book, Terror on the Tube, is now in its third edition. It was Nick who broke the case wide open by discovering that the train from Luton, that the young Islamic lads who were claimed to be responsible would have had to have taken to be at the tube stops in time for the explosions, had been canceled, which meant they weren't even capable of being in London at the designated locations in time, where it turns out there's an absolutely brilliant one-hour study from beginning to end showing that the explosions at those specific locations and times was part of a drill being run by an agency. And where you can find the study online, 7/7 Ripple Effect by Maud Dibb. Now, Nick has not only researched the numbers, as have others, but in this new book, he takes advantage of a brand new source, not heretofore available, which are known as the British Death Books. The UK had cracked the German code, and of course, the Germans, being extremely meticulous, kept records for everything. And they learned about the numbers of deaths at the different camps, which corroborate the figures of the International Committee of the Red Cross. So the best possible source for the most recent data and research is in Nick's book, Breaking the Spell, where he, of course, is also a contributor. In fact, Nick has such broad interests, he contributed a chapter each of the four parts of the book. One of the most striking, Greg, by the way, let me hasten to add, is this. It turns out that it's a law of biochemistry that bodies that die from cyanide poisoning, of which Zyklon B is a mild form, turn pink, and that the walls of chambers where Zyklon B is used as a law of material science turn blue. But we have no reports of pink bodies, and the only chambers that turned blue were those that were used for delousing, where copious quantities of Zyklon B was being used to kill body lice and to disinfect clothing and so forth, because it was a terrible problem in the camps. So it was a hygienic or sanitation measure to use vast quantities of Zyklon B, not to kill the inmates, but to keep them alive. In fact, these camps were labor camps. They weren't centers for extermination. A contributing factor to understanding is that I published a map of Auschwitz in the book, where it shows all sorts of facilities in the camp that are inconsistent with the idea of this having been a center for extermination, including a hospital with OBGYN facilities, a symphony hall for the orchestra to play, woodworking, a shop for furniture and artifacts to be made. Greg, believe it or not, they even had a brothel.
Yeah, and on the back of the book, one of the first things I saw was that you have a picture that's labeled the British soccer team at Auschwitz, and that kind of shocked me a bit. That's kind of interesting that they would have all those different things there. So these camps, even at work camps, it's kind of shocking that they would have things like a soccer team and an opera house. It seems very odd.
Well, they had inmates, and they were keeping them healthy. They were trying to keep them well. You can't get work out of a corpse. And when I discovered that photograph of the British football team at Auschwitz in Nick's book, I thought it was too good. It has so much emotional impact. I mean, look how fit those guys are, how cheerful they are. I mean, it's hard to believe. So for precisely that effect, namely to bring out, you know, the impact of the difference between the reality and the mythology, I published it there with the caption, "What? You didn't know there was a UK soccer team at Auschwitz?"
Yeah, it's definitely way different than the official narrative, but even work camps, I mean, even that's pretty bad. You know, if we were rounded up and taken to a work camp against our will, I mean, that's pretty shitty. It's not being killed, but it's not far off.
Greg, I hate to tell you, we got over 300 FEMA camps distributed all over the country. Private prisons has become a major industry. This Jade Helm thing looks as though it's the tip of the iceberg, that they're going to be extracting American citizens. They're going to be running them through these Walmarts that have been closed to serve as command and control centers and processing locations for detainees. They're putting up fences, 8 and 9 foot tall fences around them. They are tearing up the floors, remodeling them inside. We have reports from a contractor who said it appeared to him they were constructing a prison inside a Walmart. I've always wondered why they were such enormous facilities. He said there were even 4 guard towers. They've taken the doors to a Walmart in Florida, replaced them with blast-resistant doors that run 100 to 200,000. I mean, this is not merely a drill. It's a major threat to American freedom and democracy. Henry Kissinger was once asked how he intended to get Americans into those FEMA camps, and he gave a one-word answer: food. I'm terribly worried that this drought in California, which has been one of America's great agricultural centers, is being deliberately manufactured to reduce the availability of food. And that, in fact, those FEMA camps are going to be used for a whole lot of Americans. Greg, I hate to even talk about this, but it's stunning. I've done many programs about it on The Real Deal, which is now a video show since January of this year. 72 shows so far, and a half a dozen on Jade Helm. Americans need to understand what's going on here. Believe it or not, Sam Walton was an Army intelligence officer in World War II, and he ran internment camps.
Yeah, Jade Helm definitely has me concerned. I got a decent amount of questions for you about it, but I wanted to get a little more on the Holocaust. Like, also in World War II, the U.S. had internment work camps for the Japanese also. So, I mean, if we're comparing us to Nazis, I mean, we both were kind of doing the same thing, it seems, if we're looking at the true story. Would you say that?
Yes, yes. Oh, yes. And the American, the Allied bombing of German cities was massively destructive. It interdicted the railroad line, so the Germans were unable to resupply the camps. Although the claim is this was Hitler's policy, it came as news to his own highest ranking officials during the Nuremberg Tribunal, who had no idea there would be such a program to exterminate the Jews, for the reason that there wasn't such a program. They brought in a Hollywood director who shot a stunning amount of footage and then edited it very carefully to use a tiny percentage for presentation during the Nuremberg Tribunals. But what the Allies were doing was a form of collective punishment that is now recognized as a war crime. According to the Geneva Conventions of 1949, for example, you cannot punish anyone for a crime they did not personally commit. So that the Allied bombings was such an example. Hiroshima and Nagasaki was another example. Even our no-fly zone over Iraq, which led to the death of 500,000 Iraqi infants, was another illustration, as is our present sanctions on Iran. Greg, I don't know if you're aware, but our own intelligence agencies, all 16, converged in the conclusion that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons in 2007, a conclusion they reaffirmed in 2011, where even the Mossad reported to the Israeli government in 2012 that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons 3 weeks before Benjamin Netanyahu went to the United Nations and declared precisely the opposite. I'm very glad to see Barack Obama moving forward with the P5+1 resolution that may lead to, you know, weakening or removing these sanctions, because frankly, they're totally unjustified and actually under the Geneva Conventions constitute a war crime by the American people.
Oh, yeah. And I was just listening to another journalist, Abby Martin, talking about estimates as high as 2 million Iraqis died since we invaded Iraq. And I just read Israel's responsible for at least 1 million Palestinian deaths in the last 5 years. So we think of Auschwitz as the worst thing ever, and it's obviously not good, but we're talking about an official number of like 300,000 deaths, and we're told to never let history repeat, and this is the worst thing ever. But we have two situations going on right now that are way worse. And again, the American-Israeli partnership is responsible for a whole hell of a lot of it.
Oh, yeah, that was just a number. That was just a number who died in the concentration camps, which were labor camps and not extermination centers. Oh, millions died in World War II. There's no doubt about it.
Well, right.
Especially on the Russian front, you know, maybe even tens of millions. It was a ghastly event without any question whatsoever. But what has to be understood is the Allies were committing many war crimes during this event, including the massive and destructive bombing of the German cities. There's a wonderful article by Robert Forasson in the book about all of this, which is illustrated with photographs displaying the extent of the destruction. And Thomas Dalton, PhD, who has a classic book on the Holocaust entitled Debating the Holocaust, which is about to appear in a new edition, also has a wonderful chapter there about how the numbers were fabricated to get up to these fantastic millions that died by being very sloppy, counting the same names multiple times, giving minor variations. None of it was sworn to. None of it was verified. It was really an indefensible political move, but I think many were inspired to participate because they thought it would help to create a political movement to justify the founding of the nation of Israel. And indeed, it did contribute thereto, where it has taken me quite a long time putting the pieces together to realize that the principal motivation behind the Holocaust mythology is to play upon a Western sense of guilt for responsibility for having led to the extermination or allowed the extermination of 6 million Jews in gas chambers and then the burned to death in crematoria in order to gain political leverage for Israel and the Zionist movement, which is unquestionably the effect that it has had.
Yeah, you know, even in high school, one issue that I always had when hearing about the Holocaust was, if the goal was extermination of the Jews, why tattoo people right before you kill them? Or why transport them around Europe on trains instead of just killing them on site? It doesn't seem super efficient if you really do just want to wipe people out.
That's very observant of you, Greg. and even the leading representative of the Holocaust story, Elie Wiesel, does not have a tattoo, which others have suggested indicates that he's merely a face man for the movement and not was never subjected to incarceration in one of these camps.
Yeah, and that's another interesting point you bring up, and it also brings me to another question I have, because whenever this starts to get questioned, I think a lot of people start to wonder, well, how could a secret this big be kept? How could there be so many people out there writing books as Holocaust survivors, going around and, you know, talking about that side of things? Are they all in on this manipulation?
Well, it's become an industry. The Holocaust industry has made, you know, billions. I mean, and they have these museums all over the place to support this false depiction of history. It's a very powerful political movement. It's used as the backbone for Zionism. So when Gilad Atzmon, the author of The Wandering Who, who's an expert, the world's greatest tenor saxophone player, came to Madison and gave a talk about Jewish identity politics, meaning how much the political movement of Israel is based upon being a Jew and having suffered what Jews have suffered, especially during World War II. It was then when it struck me like a bolt of lightning that this had been used to play on the Western sense of guilt and gain tremendous political leverage. So there are an awful lot of persons who believe they're doing the right thing by supporting the Holocaust story because it will give Israel more political leverage and they could be less concerned with whether or not it is true or false. In fact, they know that it's false. And when there have been occasions to conduct trials, you could never get anyone under oath to claim they actually witnessed anyone being put to death in a gas chamber. I mean, we have quite an extensive chapter about this by Thomas Dalton himself that I think anyone reading would find extraordinarily revealing.
That was another issue I've had, is that if the Germans are responsible for these horrible actions against the Jews, and now the war is over, and the Jews need a safe place to call their own, I've always found it curious why Israel wasn't carved out of Germany. You know, why go to an unrelated Middle Eastern area and punish people who had nothing to do with it? You would think that if we're going to the Nuremberg trials, we're putting this one specific nation on trial and considering them to be guilty, it just seems like we would have carved that out of Germany. You know what I'm saying?
Well, it's based on a dubious historical claim of entitlement to the lands of Judea in Palestine, where it's ironic that recent studies of DNA of the population of Israel by Johns Hopkins University has shown that they're virtually all descendants of the Khazars from the Khazarian region of Ukraine, where, in fact, there's been discussion in Israel of founding a second Israel in the Crimea, another alternative having been Patagonia in Argentina. But where it's ironic that this late research on DNA reveals that the chosen people are not even genetically entitled to the promised land.
Yeah, that's interesting too. I heard that before from Jim Mars when we were talking about the history and origins of banking families. They're Khazarian, and yet no one really knows what a Khazarian is, so they've done their job there.
And of course, Jim has an afterword to the book, which is a very nice piece talking about the nature of conspiracy theories, where, you know, Greg, it's important to note that that phrase was introduced by the CIA as a way of stereotyping and dismissing critics of the Warren Commission. It wasn't that the critics had an alternative theory. They could simply see that the government's official account that Lee Oswald, him in the lone gunman and had killed JFK and wounded Governor Connally with three lucky shots, was preposterous. It was based on planted evidence, fabricated photographs, and a host of other false information. He actually passed a nitrate test showing that he had not fired a rifle or a pistol. Very embarrassing for the government for the facts to come out. So, of course, they've been suppressed, and they needed a way to dismiss in a single phrase anyone who is serious about exposing the lies being propagated by the government. So they contrived the phrase conspiracy theorists, where more accurate would be government critics. And government critics may or may not have a view about what actually happened, but it's easy to demonstrate, for example, that the official account of 9/11 has more holes in a block of Swiss cheese. So that once again, they'll trot out the tried and true phrase conspiracy theorist. But as the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December of 2005, where you can find our website at 911scholars.org, I can assure you the proof that 9/11 did not go down as the government claims is simply overwhelming.
Yeah. So in World War II, if it wasn't about being Jewish, what was the major factor, the catalyst in a person getting sent to one of these work camps?
Well, Hitler wasn't happy with the Jews. There's no doubt about it. It's just he wasn't seeking to exterminate them. He would have been happy to have exported them, to have got them out of the country. And he did get, you know, send them to these work camps. And it was a form of slave labor, but it simply wasn't that they were quite as dire as they are described. For example, we have photographs of children being liberated from Buchenwald and others being liberated from Bergen-Bergen. And they all look pretty healthy and pretty fit. Those photographs are in Nick's book, and I have several of them in this book as well.
Hmm. And so, like you said, more Catholics died at Auschwitz than Jewish people. How was it a campaign against Catholics as well? Did Hitler just hate Catholics also?
Oh, I can't answer that specific question, Greg, which is rather intriguing. Nick, I would bet, could deftly respond. But there were many, you know, enemies of the state that were being treated that way. And sad to say, you and I, for having this conversation, probably qualify as enemies of the United States today. Things have gone so far afield that the Pentagon has recently revised their definition, even about journalists, to suggest that there's a phrase that can apply to them that makes them subject to incarceration or hostile treatment as well by the American military. We have descended into an unbelievable pit of lies and deceit and deception, Greg, all to benefit the political agenda of the administration in power and the forces behind it.
Absolutely, man. And I think this is so fascinating because despite how you feel about the Holocaust, I mean, I do have a real problem with anything being illegal to research or talk about. I mean, for example, those Westboro Baptist Church people, I don't like them and their God hates fag signs and they're protesting at funerals, but I wouldn't want to lock them up for that. But this subject, there are a lot of places on this planet where you can actually go to jail just for talking about what we're talking about right now. And that's a little messed up. That makes it suspect to me.
Yeah, it's absolutely absurd that there should be any topic that's off limits. My attitude has always been, if the Holocaust was real, then research would support it. And if it was not, the world deserves to know. Well, based upon all the research I've been describing, we now know that it did not happen as historians claim, and the world deserves to know.
Yeah. So let's talk about Jade Helm a little bit, because it seems like there might be some parallels to what seems to be going on. Would you say that's true?
Yes, I would, in fact. Because Jade Helm involves a very large assembly of equipment and military forces. The apologists for Jade Helm suggest it's nothing but National Guard standard training involving some 1,200 troops. But there are more than 1,200 military vehicles alone that have been assembled for this. We have footage coming from citizens of railroad trains with 100 cars, and there are two military vehicles on each of the cars. They extend as far as the eye can see. There's the largest caravan ever seen in the history of Colorado has been passing through that state. And as a former Marine Corps officer, Greg, I can assure you, you cannot assemble a massive quantity of military equipment on this order unless you plan to deploy it. The problem is maintenance. You need to lube those vehicles. You need to give them oil changes. That requires getting them up on racks and garages. And when they're massively assembled out in the desert, and in these cases, there are no garages, there are no racks. It's clear it's for immediate deployment. We have documents coming down from U.S. Army headquarters about taking control of the human domain, about the combination of PSYOPs and special forces. There are combat troops from Iraq and Afghanistan involved in this. We have Green Berets, we have Marines, we have representatives of all four of the branches. The Pentagon recently conducted a study, believe it or not, in 2012 as to what percentage of the different military forces could be counted on to fire upon the American people. And it turned out some 70% of the National Guard would not fire on the American people. 90% of the Marines would not fire on the American people. 75% of the Air Force would fire on the American people. Very troubling, Greg. All by itself, the Pentagon should be conducting any such study.
Right.
Just as it's very troubling that we have over 300 FEMA camps. Very troubling that we have a North American command. Very troubling that the Department of Homeland Security has acquired over 2 billion rounds of 40 caliber hollow point ammunition, not even permissible in combat under the Hague Convention of 1899, because this is ammunition that's designed to tear apart bodies and kill people. Standard military ammunition is pointed and copper jacketed, designed to pass through a body to take a soldier out of combat, not to rip his body apart. And when you combine the massiveness of this event, which is supposed to begin on 15 July and end on 15 September, you have to ask yourself what's going on. I have observed more than once that an operation that extends for over 2 months is not a drill. That's an occupation.
Yeah, and you had mentioned Walmart, and I'm really intrigued by this piece of the puzzle because I have had some researchers come on the show and say that other researchers are trying to connect unrelated things and that the Walmart closures are more about manufacturing an excuse for Wall Street when they see just how bad retail numbers really are. So they can push it off and say that, oh, well, we were doing all this maintenance on stores and distract from the fact that the economy is really crashing. But you're saying you've talked to people and gotten reports of some of the details and what they're really doing in these Walmart facilities. It shows that it's not just plumbing maintenance.
Oh, yeah. That was just a story. That was just a cover story. At none of these Walmarts has any effort been made to get plumbing permits. I mean, it was ridiculous on its face. They closed them abruptly. It turns out there are longstanding agreements between FEMA and Walmart that anytime FEMA needs them, Walmarts will close and turn themselves over to FEMA. They're being reconfigured to be sources of logistics supply for the operations in the field. I mean, what could be more obvious? A Walmart is a place you go to get supplies, normally in the past civilian. Now in this new guise, military. You need a tank? Call Walmart. You need a helicopter? Call Walmart. They're bringing tons and tons and tons of military equipment, ammunition, weapons, and so forth to these Walmarts. They are taking these massive steel shipping containers you'd normally find on a freighter at sea, which are loaded with all kinds of equipment, including, I surmise, bars to construct prisons inside the Walmarts. And they're using the containers themselves to block off access to the rear of the Walmarts and create what appear to be exercise areas for the detainees where they can't possibly escape unless they could scale those massive steel barriers. And, of course, that's not about to happen. So we have the Walmart serving multiple functions: command and control, logistics supply, and detainee processing, where they'll figure out which FEMA camp to send you to. I have no doubt they're going to split up families and children one place, parents, husbands one place, wives another. I mean, it's all completely awful and very much on the order of what we have been told about the operation of these German work camps. And they're going to put the Americans who are incarcerated to work. We have these private prisons in the South that have been hiring new personnel in anticipation of a rapid expansion. It cannot be a coincidence that this is taking place at the same time that Jade Helm is gearing up to go full throttle, where I must say I admire the governor of Texas, whose name is Abbott, who has directed the Texas State Guard to monitor Jade Helm. A new survey in Texas shows that 55% of Texans are wary of these military operations within their state, as well they should be. It augurs no good for the American people. And as I may have already observed, I regard this as the greatest threat to freedom and democracy in the United States that our nation has ever confronted in its history.
Yeah, it's definitely a scary thing. I have such a hard time kind of finding where the line is between some people's paranoia, I guess, spouting off all kinds of things online. You know, of course that happens. And then getting the real truth here, it definitely seems concerning and scary. I'm curious why Walmart would do this, because it's kind of PR suicide for the brand. They could never really exist again after doing something like this.
Well, it turns out Walmart's received billions and billions of dollars in subsidy from the government, that these arrangements with FEMA appear to have been in place from the beginning. In other words, these Walmarts appear to have been designed to be dual-purpose facilities. Civilian in normal times, military in times of need, determined strictly by FEMA. And as I may or may not have already mentioned, Sam Walton was an Army intelligence officer in World War II and ran detention camp facilities. So he was a perfect guy to understand what might be needed if these Walmarts to be were to be converted in the future for precisely that function.
And I've heard that Utah and Texas, you know, of course, they're big in this operation. I've heard they're being targeted because they're trying to start issuing currency in gold and silver through some back channel legislation. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, that's extremely interesting. I know that Texas has asked for the return of $1 billion in gold. I guarantee you they won't get it. Germany wanted to have the return of some $7 billion in gold. Germany didn't get it. I wouldn't be surprised if the vaults at Fort Knox are actually completely empty and bereft of any gold whatsoever. But the fact of the matter is we have this very elaborate military operation taking place. It's in violation of Posse Comitatus, a statute from 1878 that precludes the use of military force to perform police function. They're trying to get around it by asking permission for various communities and landowners for the right to use their property. None of those permissions ought to be granted. All of them ought to be rescinded. And of course, this is obvious. A blatant violation of the Fourth Amendment, given that we have learned from some who have been trained in Jade Helm that their objective in going home to home is going to be to confiscate guns and excess food. In other words, someone is going to be designated a food hoarder if they have more than 1 week's worth of supplies on hand. Now, Greg, why should anyone have any restriction on how much food they want to hoard? It can only be because Henry Kissinger's position is being implemented, to wit, they want to manipulate the American people by putting them in a state of starvation where they don't have access to food, so that that can be used as a leverage to get them to voluntarily enter these FEMA camps. If you're facing starvation or entering a FEMA camp, many Americans would prefer to enter a FEMA camp, even if that means consigning their lives thereafter to a state of slavery. I myself am unwilling to adopt that approach. I am a stand-your-ground kind of guy, and I am going to resist any effort made to deprive me of my right to keep and bear arms. And the whole scenario is a travesty. It's draconian. It's Orwellian. And they're using a whole series of these incidents that are fabricated. I'm talking about Sandy Hook. I'm talking about the Boston bombing. I'm talking about Ferguson, Missouri. I'm talking about the Walter Scott shooting. I'm even talking about Charleston, about which I've just done a lengthy program last night, revealing that these are all contrived one way or another. These are all staged or fabricated events. Take, for example, Charleston, which is foremost on everyone's mind, given its currency that it has just happened. There's a famous photograph of this young man entering the back of the church, but it turns out he's actually wearing a $1,000 bulletproof vest, which the government hasn't acknowledged, and the date and the time on the image are wrong. They're not for the date and the time. In fact, the time is like 8:30 in the morning, whereas this event, the shooting, took place in the evening. I think they had someone involved in processing this who didn't understand a 24-hour clock. And they thought if it said, you know, the time read to them as though it was 8:17, they thought that meant p.m., when, of course, 0800 is a.m., that to be p.m., it would have to be 2000, not 0800. So, you know, I think there were glitches here. The people we're dealing with are not all rocket scientists. And, you know, even Dick Gregory gave a 1-hour interview about Charleston, where he was reflecting that he was very troubled that they didn't have a series of ambulances there immediately to take the bodies or the dead or wounded off to hospitals where they could be declared dead or alive. That this is just what happened at Sandy Hook. They didn't have a surge of EMTs into the building. They didn't have a series of ambulances. Officially, the bodies were all left in a heap in the classroom until they were removed in the dead of night. That's completely absurd. We'd all been troubled by indication that something was wrong at Sandy Hook. There was a sign, for example, that said everyone must check in. That seemed very odd. We have video from inside the firehouse showing stacks of pizza cartons and bottled water. That seemed very odd. There were porta potties there. People had their name tags on color-coded, you know, on lanyards that were color-coded. We had parents bringing children to the event. This has all been most puzzling. Wolfgang Halbig, who's a former Florida state trooper and a former school principal and a nationally recognized school safety expert, simply sought to find information about what had happened to Sandy Hook so he could share it with other school districts when he conducted symposia on school safety. And he found that none of his FOIA requests were being answered, none of his phone calls were being returned. And the next thing he knew, two detectives from the homicide branch of the local police were on his doorstep in his gated community telling him that if he continued to raise questions about Sandy Hook, the Connecticut State Police were going to prosecute him. Well, that was the wrong thing to say to Wolfgang. He's pursued the matter to the extent that we're now making significant legal breakthroughs about which I will describe momentarily. We have in the meanwhile discovered the manual, the FEMA manual for Sandy Hook, where it explains right in the manual, there's going to be a rehearsal on the 13th that says right in the manual, everyone must check in. It says right in the manual, refreshments and restrooms will be provided. They won't let information about the porta potties, as innocuous as that sound, reach Wolfgang because it would reveal they were delivered on the 13th when the shooting officially took place on the 14th. This is a huge, elaborate scam. It explains why parents would be bringing children to the scene of a child shooting massacre. There was no massacre. No children died. It was an elaborate hoax, as indeed was the Boston bombing.
Man, yeah, that's super fascinating. And in terms of this most recent shooting, that's kind of what I'm curious. Well, they also found out, I've read that there was a military operation, a drill conducted at the same time, which is one of the go-to pieces of evidence we find, whether it's 9/11 or the Boston bombing or Sandy Hook or now Charleston. There always seems to be a military exercise going on at the same time. And I think that creates a lot of confusion. It also seems like what might be happening is just these military drills with crisis actors end up going live, and they might not even know it.
Greg, you're absolutely right. I mean, what sense would it make to have an active shooter drill going on in Charleston, South Carolina, and a prominent political figure like Hillary Clinton being there at the same time? What's the probability she would be campaigning with a minister who would be shot that evening during the day before the shooting? And because she was coincidentally there, she was able to send her personal photographer into the church to take photographs that no doubt are going to show up in subsequent campaign commercials. You got to be kidding me. It turns out that just as a Sandy Hook school was in an advanced state of decay, it was loaded with asbestos and other biohazards, which led me during a visit to the Newtown School Board in the company of Wolfgang Halbig to ask the school board when were the parents informed that their children were attending classes in a toxic waste dump. It turns out this historic school, this historic church in Charleston, South Carolina, is infested with termites and in serious need of repair. Well, miracle upon miracle, the Barack Obama administration is now fast-tracking $26 or $29 million to benefit the survivors, but none of whom, like the survivors of the Sandy Hook victims, act like they've actually suffered a tragedy. We have Robbie Parker, whose daughter Emily supposedly died the following evening. He was meeting a press conference. He came out of the building all jovial and joking until he saw the crowd, and then he stopped hyperventilating and got into his character and didn't forget to mention the donation page for his daughter Emily. And we have interviews with the children of a mother who allegedly died during the shooting, talking perfectly normally and tranquilly about how love is stronger than hate, and they don't show a single emotion, no anxiety, no tears, no grief. We even had one of the mothers of a Sandy Hook victim on with Anderson Cooper, and she not only is not in grief, she's actually flirting with Anderson Cooper, apparently not knowing his orientation. But it's just astounding, Greg, how much deceit and deception is taking place here. I've just done this an hour and 20-minute program on the Charleston shooting, which you can find online, Real Deal, episode number 72, Why Charleston Appears to Be Another Staged Event.
Man, yeah, this has been a really interesting year if you are into media analysis, because this race theme that they keep throwing out there, whether it's the police brutality issues, which I think is a real problem, or now this Charleston shooting, and now this Confederate flag talk, it seems like the media is doing everything they can to get the citizens of the United States divided, and that seems like something you would want to do right before a really sketchy event like a Jade Helm.
Well, it's very interesting, Greg, because, for example, in Ferguson, the body of Michael Brown was left lying in the street for 4 hours. Now, that's obviously needlessly provocative. Assuming that was a real body, why would you leave it lying in the sun for 4 hours? An ambulance should have shown up and the body taken away within 15 minutes.
Right.
That's 3 hours and 45 minutes quicker than actually happened. In fact, when they took the body up, they sort of threw it in the back of a vehicle as though it were a dummy, which it may in fact have been. The shooting of Walter Scott, which also occurred in South Carolina, is itself very puzzling, where this officer fires 8 shots at a black man who's running away from him, purportedly hits him 5 times, but his body shows no reaction to the impact of any of those bullets, Greg. It looks as though that's another contrived event. And because they were unable to create the cadre of anti-gun lobbyists out of Sandy Hook, they seem to be moving forward with different variations on the theme, where now they switch it to have a white boy shoot 9 black people in an historic church. I mean, the Obama administration is nothing if not imaginative about how to vary the cadence and bring about one event after another. The day of the Sandy Hook shooting, in fact, the governor, whose name is Malloy, and his lieutenant governor held a press conference during which Malloy explained they had been spoken to that something like this might happen, which led me to ponder, spoken to something like this, what could he possibly mean? There are only 2 alternatives. Number one, that someone was going to come into a public school in Connecticut and shoot a bunch of children, in which case he ought to have issued an alarm to all the school districts to warn them to elevate their security level, which he did not do. Or number two, that he was told they were going to take an abandoned school, conduct a drill, and make it look like a real event to promote an anti-gun agenda, which is exactly what happened. And when I asked by whom he had been spoken to, it turned out that none other than Attorney General Eric Holder had visited with him about 3 weeks prior to the event to promote his own aggressive anti-gun control agenda, where we even have footage of Eric Holder addressing a Democratic Women's Conference in Washington, D.C. in 1995, already talking about having to change the attitude of Americans toward guns, even if it required brainwashing them. That's not my phrase. That's his.
Wow. Well, Jim, this has been amazing. I guess we'll bring it in with that. Again, I loved the book. I'm looking forward to the others in the series. Would you like to give the folks some closing info on the book and where they can get it, maybe where they can keep up with you?
Well, you can find it at Amazon.com, of course, and also through CreateSpace. My blog is jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. You want to check out The Real Deal, just go to do a search on NBC Media Broadcasting Center, The Real Deal Archives, and you can find them online. There are now 72 of these video shows. And, of course, the 880 from the past can be found at radiofetzer.blogspot.com. And, Greg, I just want to thank you for featuring me on the show. I think you do a great job, and I've really very much enjoyed being on with you today.
Oh, thanks, man. I loved it, too. A conspiratorial cornucopia, a rapid-fire dismantling of many illusions. You do great work. So thanks so much for spending the time with me and for doing what you do. Hopefully we can do it again sometime. But until then, you know, keep fighting the good fight.
That would be my pleasure, Greg. Some might say this may be the most dangerous book in the world, and they just might be right.
Well said, well said. All right, man. Well, stay safe out there.
Thanks, Greg.
Sweet baby Jesus. Jim Fetzer, ladies and gentlemen. All right. I'm glad we had a chance to talk about the moon landing hoax. We've been kind of brushing over it a lot lately, but those details, they are important. Also, the Holocaust and Jade Helm, between the three of them, those are probably my most requested topics right now, all in one show. How you like that? People always ask me what I think on these things, and I just don't know. I'm pretty open. I mean, I'm like 90% sure the moon landings were faked. I'm about 75% sure the Holocaust was more about slave work than it was about a genocide. And I'm like 50% worried about Jade Helm. That's where I lean today, but it does fluctuate because I just don't know. New information is always presented, and I always feel like there's this tug on my consciousness to bring me back to consensus reality. It's tough, but we do what we can. In the Plus show, we talked more about Jade Helm, the replacement of Paul McCartney, and the doubles for Saddam and Bin Laden that were used for propaganda purposes, another threat I hadn't really heard all that much about. We also talked about the whispers of an economic collapse in September, October, and how Obama seems to be making a play to extend his reign. It seems like the kind of thing that just can't happen in today's world, but a guy like Jim makes me less sure of anything. I mean, look at Greece. Who knows what's going to happen this week, but they can't make their $1.5 billion payment to the IMF. Now they've locked up the banks. ATM lines are around the block, and citizens are limited to $67 a day in withdrawals. I mean, that's happening as I speak in a modernized nation. It could happen here too. Let's just hope that when something big does happen, we take our cues from the nations who have thrown the bankers in jail, have rejected the Rothschild banking network and the debt-based system of rule. That's all we can do, and then hopefully we can weather that storm and come out on the other side with something better. But don't drive yourself crazy. I know conspiracy folks are always saying that the collapse is coming, but this seems to be more than just the usual folks. And I would take Scar from The Lion King's advice on this one and be prepared. And prepared to me does not mean getting a gun to defend my house from intruders. If we get to that point, we've already lost. Killing the first 10 intruders before I'm overrun doesn't really serve a purpose. Look, we know our time in this reality is limited. Just enjoy what you can while you can. Why worry about a collapse in October when you could die in a car accident today? Stay in the moment. I don't know. But that's the show. I'm really hoping to have the THC Plus bonus show up in the next 48 hours or so. It's fairly short and a little disappointing, but it's hard to not get something out of listening to a guy who ran a Washington, D.C. gay escort service for politicians and was on the fringes of a child pedophilia network. You gotta get something out of that. And it should be up soon. And that said, thanks again for listening and sharing the show. It is such a huge deal. It's the only way we grow, and we're moving up every day of the week. And this marks the fifth show of the month, so I'd say June had a pretty decent roster, and I hope everybody is geared up to kick July's ass. I know I am. So go get it, people. That is it for me today. Your move, savvy sorcerers and conspiratorial crafters of the cognitive constructs of history. Your frickin' move.
Have a drink and a smoke. Listen to the cast. We shine a shiny spotlight. Put criminals on blast. The pinstripe men of mourning and families of finance. DuPont, Windsor, and Rothschild. The kids don't stand a chance. The kids don't. The kids don't stand, the kids don't stand a chance. I said the kids don't stand, the kids don't stand a chance. We're looking for the answers to questions never asked. So we come to the Carwood for the higher side chats. The pinstripe men of mourning and families of finance. DuPont, Windsor, and Rothschild. The kids don't stand a chance. The kids don't. The kids don't stand. The kids don't stand a chance. I said the kids don't. The kids don't stand. The kids don't stand a chance. Involved in shady business, we try to get a glance. We're working on the numbers, resistance must advance. The pinstripe men of mourning and families of finance, DuPont, Windsor, and Rothschild, the kids don't stand a chance. The kids don't, the kids don't stand, the kids don't stand a chance. I said the kids don't, the kids don't stand, the kids don't stand a chance. The kids don't, the kids don't stand, the kids don't stand a chance. I said the kids don't, the kids don't stand, the kids don't stand a chance.